Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. My guest today is Carol Sklenica, and we'll be discussing Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, recently published by Scribner's. And first of all, Carol, thank you so much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you.
Carol, Raymond Carver was an important American writer. And how long did you work on this biography? This is the first major biography. I remember reading what we talk about when we talk about Raymond Carver or something like, I think Sam Halpern did it. But this is the first major biography. And how much time did you spend on this?
I began working on the book really shortly after Sam Halpern's book came out, because I read those interviews and I thought they were terrific. And but I thought that a full-scale biography needed to be written. There were a lot of obstacles to that because Carver had a complicated life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, I started interviewing early people. I wanted to go back earlier than Sam did, and I talked to people that knew Ray's parents. This was in the early 90s that I first started thinking about it. So I rounded off to 10 years, but it was really longer.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I could tell when I read it. And one of the things that I found fascinating as I was reading was people tend to think of Raymond Carver, and they think of the term minimalist, and that he as a short story writer, and they tended to look a lot at the structure of his stories rather than the content. And I think your biography, and I just like your opinion on this, it seems to me that his stories were better than he was given credit for.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by better. I think they're, once you know the background to the stories, they begin to seem denser, I think, and more rooted in not only his life, but American lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of his little so-called minimalist details just carry a tremendous resonance for me.
Yeah, I guess when I say that, maybe perhaps I mean it, the type of people he wrote about were certainly different than a lot of short story writers had written about, and but there is a depth and a complexity to them that I guess as time goes on and I go back and I reread them, I find myself enjoying them more and more with each reading.
I found that to be true. I mean, I never got tired of his work in 15 years of thinking about it, well, longer than that, because I first read him in 1976. Those people are very, I mean, what he was able to do with the short story was really compress novels into short stories. You can imagine whole lives from those stories.
And When I was looking back at it, I think I was kind of surprised at almost, I don't know if the word's naivete, but you did a very good job of painting how close to the cuff he was writing these stories that were being published, which is kind of amazing for anybody that's ever sought publication, how so often he had things in the mail and how quickly he sold things and how different the environment was that he was working in at the time.
He worked really hard at his writing career. It wasn't some miracle that just swooped down on him because the editor of Esquire noticed him, which was a wonderful thing. But, he just always kept his work in the mail, and I don't think it always was quickly published. I hope I didn't give that impression. There were
or maybe I guess that came
to,
with his success, yeah.
Yeah, but it was noticed. The editors of small magazines noticed it, but he played that game for many, many years. And I've published work too. It's exhausting.
It was interesting. I thought it's hard to talk about Carver with talking about the importance of Marianne and his family. And I liked the way that you wove the struggles that they had as a couple into, and it's a well chronicled story. But how did you go about approaching that as when you were writing the first few parts of the book, trying to piece all of that together?
I interviewed a lot of people who knew Carver, and I was eventually able to interview Marianne and both of his children, as well as his sister-in-law, Amy, and her husband, Doug Unger. So I got a lot of close information. But there was almost so much of it that I had to, of course I had to pare it down and shape it. And that's where the stories were helpful, because he was such an autobiographical writer. That gave me a clue, I guess, of what material was important to him and how he transformed it.
You did a good job, I think, too, of interviewing students. His relationship with the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop was very interesting.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about kind of the brief history of Carver's relationship with them?
Well, the University of Iowa Workshop, at the time Carver graduated college, which was 1962, was one of the best and only workshops in the country. There weren't as many as there are now. And so he was recommended there by his teachers, and he went because he thought that would be a sure road to success and publication. And when he got there, first of all, he didn't like living in Iowa. He was from Northern California and Washington states, and he struggled. He was not comfortable with the critique sessions, which tended to be very harsh. A lot of people showing off, being hypercritical of each other's work, and he just faded. He just kind of scrunched in the corner and had very few critiques of his work done in workshop, didn't get along with his teachers, started probably drinking a little more than he had before, and wasn't noticed. Near the end of the year, his wife got upset that he hadn't received a fellowship for the next year, and she took all his work into the office of Paul Engel, who was then the leader of the workshop, the director of the workshop. And she sat in his office for hours until he noticed her and did what she wanted, which was take her husband's work for the weekend and have some faculty read it. And he came back and said, oh, well, this guy's great. He should have a fellowship. Oddly enough, by that time, Carver was burned out and didn't want to stay at Iowa. So even though the fellowship was finally offered, he left and never completed his MFA degree. Though he later put it on his resume, he never got the degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Iowa, nonetheless, hired him to teach there in the 1970s and celebrates him as someone who was at the workshop. So It's all a funny story, very revealing of race psychology, I think. But.
Yeah, and there are just some harrowing stories of he and John Cheever. The stories are, just staggering. I have more than a passing knowledge of the evils of alcohol, shall we say. And even I was stunned at the amount of drinking that Cheever did.
We all have, I guess, in this society, seen what alcohol can do, but Carver was unbelievable. And with Cheever, he just got worse. He told his friend Dan Domench that Cheever had really shown him where this alcohol was going to lead, and it was to death's door. And Cheever, of course, got sober and was celebrated for that, but only lived about 2 more years. Carver, luckily, lived 10 more years after he got sober. So it is kind of a turning point in American literature that we suddenly have writers who get sober and keep writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's the picture of him in the last couple years is absolutely heartbreaking to read, how hard he was trying to change, and the relationship with his children. It's great that you had access to his two children, because with some of the essays that he later wrote, Fires and some of the others, he really was really focused on writing, wasn't he? I mean, his entire life, that really did, was really the focus of it.
It was for his entire life, and during his unhappy years, he wasn't writing enough, and I think that added to his unhappiness. I think I talked to a psychologist the other night who attended one of my readings, and he said, you know, Carver really hit bottom many times, but his sobriety didn't stick until he got an advance for a novel. And that's true.
Yeah, and tell
he,
I had
needed
never...
that hope, I think.
Sure. There are many short story writers that Andre Debuse, you know, I mean, many others who wrote one beautifully, and people are always trying to, you know, convince them to write novels. And it seems like Carver really wanted to, but the novels that he took on, if you would just talk briefly about the time he went abroad and really wanted to write a novel, and it was tragic, but comic at times,
yeah,
too.
Sure, I will talk about that, and I will get back to the children, too, because I ran away from your question there. He spent a few months in Israel on an overseas program with his wife, Marianne, and he hated being there, but he did absorb a lot of material. He hated it for personal reasons. Mainly, I think he had to run the household while she was at school, and he didn't want to do that. And he felt lost in that part of the world. But he picked up a lot of details that he might have used in a novel, but he just never could pull it together. And I think he had a very exalted notion of a novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he would have put his mind to writing a sequence of short stories the way people do nowadays, he probably could have done it. But
mm-hmm.
He admired novelists like Wallace Stegner, who, you know, mm-hmm. who wrote big, complicated novels with intricate plots, and he just couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
He also tried to write, he proposed other novels, like he was going to write something about the Germans in Africa during World War I, and he was serious, reason, but that was really way off of his talent.
Yeah. And the amazing thing was he got advances on it.
Yeah, he did. But you almost wonder if they were sympathy advances.
Yeah, exactly.
He was quite the trickster. He could persuade people. And
well,
and I think this takes us back to the kids. I think he really had a kind of double personality. And he had a very loving relationship with his children, but not to the point where he would sacrifice himself for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or be happy sacrificing himself for them anyway.
Yeah, and then when he achieved the success, it seems like he really did try to, try to be a good father. And I think he always was in his own mind, you know, a good father. But to use the word dysfunctional family doesn't do it justice. I mean, the mother and the brother and the, you know, and the sisters-in-laws. And I mean, it seemed like as soon as one was doing well, the other five fell apart.
That's certainly how it seemed, and of course I had access to a lot of Carver's letters, and that's how he presented it. Other members of the family do have their own view of it, different views. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, Marianne would say that the family was always pretty functional, except during the years of Ray's drinking, and that was the only problem. And,
yeah,
she has
yeah.
a point.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a little blind to that.
Yeah, yeah, and. I found it was very fascinating, and I really liked the research you did into vintage contemporaries and how critical a role Gary Fiskejohn played in really promoting Carver's work in that format. I remember when Jane McKinney, I remember when Bright Lights, Big City came out, and when they started doing Carver, that was a very fortuitous moment in time for him, wasn't it?
Fortuitous was a... He was a lucky guy.
Yeah.
He was lucky that he knew Gordon Lish before Gordon Lish became the fiction editor at Esquire, and he was lucky that Gary Fiskejohn sought him out shortly before Fiskejohn invented the whole concept of the vintage trade paperbacks that, you know, brought paperback reading to a whole different group of people, kind of took it out of the supermarket and brought it to the bookshop.
Mm-hmm.
Very classy editions that that people were able to carry around with them and read on the subway or wherever. So that really gave Carver a whole new audience.
Yes, and
in the 80s when short stories were in the ascendance.
Yes. And the pictures, I love the pictures in the book, too, because when you look at some of the later things like No Heroics, Please, and you have that bold Carver looking out at the camera, and some of the pictures you have of kind of the old Ray when he was still drinking with the mutt and sideburns and disheveled. I mean, it's like it's almost like, you know, GQ came in and airbrushed him into a human being.
Yeah. Apparently he enjoyed that. I know his second wife, Tess Gallagher, gave him haircuts, and he bought himself Italian suits and, you know, bought himself a Mercedes. He lived well in the last few years of his life, but it's interesting to see the contrast. Same guy underneath, I suspect.
Yeah. He, you know, and it's really happy. I mean, as a writer, you're just delighted to see when somebody gets it like he did for the period of time that he did. And Carol, how would you summarize the role of poetry? Some people thought that when Carver found out he was sick, that he began to write more poetry because of the format. Do you think that's true, or do you think it was more of maybe an impact of Tess Gallagher and what he felt like writing at the time?
The first thing is certainly not true, because he started writing poetry intensely in about 1984. Before he knew he was sick.
Mm-hmm.
Tess Gallagher, sure, she had a big impact. She took his poetry seriously, and because she was a poet. And I think his poetry grew in new directions while they were together. But he had always written poetry from the very beginning of his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was never a new thing. It came along with the fiction all along, and he sometimes told people he was a poet first.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps there was a financial flexibility he had as well.
Absolutely. He was able to write whatever he wanted because he'd won a huge, not really huge, I try to make a point of saying it was a comfortable amount of money. He was getting $35,000 a year
mm-hmm.
from a grant, and that allowed him not to teach and gave him the flexibility to write whatever he wanted. And I guess proves that he really wasn't greedy, because he could have made more money writing short stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he also was kind of a little concerned. He didn't want people to think he had too much money.
Well, he didn't want his family.
Yeah. Carol, what was probably maybe the most surprising thing that you discovered about Carver as you were doing this? When you finish the book and then it's an exhaustive work, and it reads very quickly. I thoroughly enjoyed it. When you were done, what surprised you most? What did you learn the most about Carver, do you think?
You know, nothing surprised me by the time I was done, because I spent a long time with it, and I was by then used to his trickster personality, so mm-hmm. even the outcome of his will and so forth did not surprise me, although there were things there that surprised me when I found out that he really wasn't attending to his business or solving some of the dilemmas between his family and his money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but
that's not disappointing.
Know, it's not
I
surprising.
Understand.
I was very surprised when I found out he'd been in the National Guard, but
yes.
There wasn't a lot to make of it. He was barely there.
Let me ask you this. Carver, his sobriety was definitely a turning point in his life. I mean, no question. The way he maintained his sobriety could be considered I don't know if I want to say suspect, but there are those who would say that Carver certainly didn't follow the precepts of recovery programs, and I guess that was a little surprising to me that he continued in smoking marijuana and some different things, and it didn't seem to be a problem with him.
that's something I puzzled over and couldn't answer because I'm very aware of what an AA person would say about mm-hmm. Carver's. I don't even know whether to call it dependency on marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there were times when he traveled that he probably didn't have it available to him.
Mm-hmm.
He may have used Valium or something else, but he needed something to calm him down, and that's what he used.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he smoked mostly in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Northern California, where pot is practically legal. And
yeah.
I'm sorry to say that there are people who are addicted to pot now. It's not.
Oh yeah.
It's not just recreational.
I'm well aware of that. And so that was a bit of a dichotomy, I think, as I was reading it, and I was very grateful, I guess, that he was able to do that.
Yeah.
Because many others have tried unsuccessfully. A lot of people would have been thrown back into drinking. Mm-hmm.
That's what they say. And, mm-hmm. You know, one substance will lead to another, and that mm-hmm. didn't happen to him. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank goodness.
But, of course, marijuana probably contributed to his lung cancer. So.
Yeah. It was also interesting to read about, it's always kind of a dicey thing when an author dies and work is published, you know, after their death.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your take on what's been published after Carver died in terms of how it will affect his legacy, if it will affect his legacy at all?
I think it's muddied the water for his legacy right now. I guess the question is whether the work is good enough to triumph over that and bring all that stuff along with it. I think that may be true. That's what I'm getting from the response to the biography, is that people really want to know everything about Carver, and they're willing to take whatever they find.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing for his legacy. These early versions of the stories are problematic because mm-hmm. they don't really clarify anything. They're the ones that have just been published in the Library of America edition, the ones under the title Beginners,
mm-hmm.
are completely unedited, and I don't think Carver wanted completely unedited work out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still hoping that the middle versions of these manuscripts will turn up and we can see what it was that Carver wanted published. Tess Gallagher keeps finding more things, and there actually are still more things to find at Ohio State that she hasn't published. You know, minor things, notes, sketches.
Yeah.
I don't know if it will go
yeah.
on forever or
right.
not.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Some of the five new stories she found a few years ago are not as good as the ones he published. And, you know, I don't know if he would have published them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Carol, I want to thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed it. I highly recommend Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life by Scribner's. It's obvious that it was a labor of love, and I really think you present a balanced look at Carver, the warts and the bright spots. So congratulations on writing what I think will be the definitive biography of Carver.
Thank you so much for your time.
Okay.
Enjoyed it.
Very good. Well, take care. And look forward to meeting up with you down the road.